This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Ranchford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information and answers all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning. And I have an exciting guest today. My guest, who will be with us at 11:20, is going to be Dr. Michael Rajkumar. Dr. Rajkumar has been a guest on our program before. He is a specialist in infectious diseases. And you know, lately, the attack on science, as we have seen with this measles outbreak, and we're starting to see with pertussis, this national reaction against science has particularly focused on infectious diseases. So we want to spend some time with him to really get the science down and how it pertains to our lives and how we keep ourselves safe. So we will be with Dr. Rajkumar later on. We're hearing a lot now about immigration and really taking people and sending them back to their countries. We're revoking the visas of students. And whenever I hear stories about that, I always try to think, how does that or did that apply to me? And as many of you know, I went to medical school at the University of Rome in Italy. And I had to have a visa. I had a visa to go to Italy. And I had to appear for my visa periodically to renew it and show them my libretto. Libretto is a book you have with all your grades and the courses you're taking to show that I was still taking these courses. And they were kind enough to give me that visa and get me to finish my medical education and say, fine, you're educated and you can return back to your country. Now, that was in the late 70s and early 80s, from 76 to 81. Today, there are thousands of medical students from the United States, Americans, who are studying in foreign medical schools, whether they be in the Caribbean, Ireland, Poland. I worked with a young woman this summer, who's studying in Poland, where they actually teach in English at certain schools. And the reason they have gone abroad is we don't have enough capacity to train physicians in this country. Some brilliant people in the 1960s decided we would make this an exclusive club and not build more medical schools to adequately take care of the needs of a growing population and an older population. So we have a shortage of physicians, and we don't have the ability to train them. So many young people who are very bright go abroad to study. And I started thinking, what would it have been like if I got to my last year and suddenly some politician decided, we don't want Americans here anymore. We revoked the visa. I wouldn't be a doctor. And that's the case, really, for thousands of Americans. So understand, it's not just foreign students who are coming here to learn. And by the way, pay tuition. Okay, so their countries have sent them here to learn, many to go back. Some are willing to stay here and help us expand our knowledge. So we really have to think of this whole thing with immigration and revoking student visas with the idea that there may be Americans coming back from other countries. Another thing that came up this week is the VA asking employees to report anti-Christian bias. And I thought this was interesting because And excuse my coughing. I have a head cold. But there's now a task force to investigate employee reports of alleged anti-Christian bias among colleagues. So we've created a situation where we have employees of the VA now reporting other workers if there's been anti-Christian discrimination. Now, I started thinking, what is this anti-Christian? Christian is to be Christ-like, right? If anything is anti-Christian, it's been the policies of our government now. Denying food to hungry children through USAID. Denying HIV medications. Restricting access for Americans to the VA, Social Security, Medicare. Meals on Wheels, again. These are Christian acts to help other people. And now getting rid of the Narcan program for overdoses. So there are anti-Christian things to report, but they are against our government. One of the things that's particularly puzzling is the fact that they have really started to cut back on research. One of the research projects that is threatened to be cut back is on ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. This study has been going on in Harvard for years, is making great headway, and may be in jeopardy. Now, these are not studies you just turn off and then turn back on. When you turn them off, you have to start from the beginning. There are also studies being done on women's health, and particularly various health things that affect women. So we need to be mindful of this, and if we are going to profess ourselves to be Christian, we need to really look at the overall policies going forward when it comes to health. This month is Autism Awareness Month, and I've spent a lot of time talking about autism, but this week we found out that there is a proposed autism registry, a national database to track Americans with autism. My goodness. We are now going to require people with autism to register. Well, anybody with a physical illness should not have to report that to the federal government and be tracked. Now, there are some states that have autism registries. There are 7 states. Among them, Delaware, Indiana, North Dakota, New Jersey, Rhode Island, West Virginia. And these registries have been used to help people with autism in many respects. But they've been around for years. And in fact, New Hampshire got rid of it. And the reason is because this proposed national autism registry allows NIH to collect private medical records from federal and commercial databases. So we're allowing the federal government to have access to the medical records of people with autism. You know, they've already come out and said, Robert F. Kennedy, our leader here when it comes to health, has already said, these folks don't pay taxes, they can't work. They can't use a toilet effectively. So there's discussion that this is the beginning. I mean, when governments do this, and it's been done before, right, this is the first step towards eugenics. And we have to be extremely mindful of that as we move forward. So we really need to reject any registry that's national in terms of recording people's illnesses. It's just not who we are. This day in medicine. This is April 26, 1829. Dr. Christian Billroth, a German surgeon, was born. Dr. Billroth was the father of American of intestinal surgery. He was a German surgeon, as I said. And he performed resection of the stomach with reattachment to the duodenum or jejunum. So basically, in 1829, he performed the first gastric bypass, which is the same procedure we use today for a lot of weight loss. It's also what we have done, and it's not just used for weight loss, but also for people with diabetes and other illnesses. So it has been helpful, and that's Dr. Bill Roth. With that, we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Michael Rajkumar. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you. And with my guest. My guest today is Dr. Michael Rajkumar, who is a specialist in infectious diseases. He works for Hartford Healthcare and is located at Backus Hospital. And he's been a friend of mine for many years and a guest of on this program before. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tony. As always, pleasure to be with you.
So as you can tell from the first part of this program, I'm coming down. I have been fighting off a common cold, for lack of a better term. And, you know, what do we know about the common cold? You know, we use that term pretty generally. Is it a virus? How do we get it? Is it seasonal? Can you explain it to us in some detail?
I mean, common cold is, as the state, it's just a infection which causes a combination of symptoms like a runny nose, cough, sneezing, sore throat, headache, body ache, fever, things like that. You know, what we call like flu-like symptoms and, you know, what we commonly refer to. But they are all mostly caused by viruses. And, you know, as we in the medical field called upper respiratory infection, that's what it causes. Though we all think that it is more common in the winter months and stuff like that, it can happen year-round depending on which virus is causing. There are many viruses that cause this type of upper respiratory infection. The most common ones that we all know, you know, flu and RSV also, you know, they all cause flu and flu-like symptoms. But there are other viruses. There are enteroviruses, parainfluenza viruses, metapneumoviruses. They all can cause similar symptoms. And the one virus that stands out mostly, aside from the flu and RSV, is rhinovirus. It is an enterovirus, and that usually is there year-round, though it can be more common in early fall and spring right now. So probably you got rhinovirus, this being, you know, springtime. Now, it causes the same kind of symptoms, you know, the runny nose to cough and cold-like symptoms. But in some people who have underlying respiratory conditions like asthma, COPD, for them it can sometimes exacerbate these underlying illness and cause more severe illnesses. It can, in, you know, cases lead to pneumonia, but most often it is self-limiting and, you know, gets better in about 7 to 10 days or so.
Mike, so what helps it? In other words, should you be taking medication for it, and what medications help?
So aside from the influenza, RSV, and COVID-19, they all can present similarly, right? We have vaccines. But for all the other viral illnesses, we do not have vaccine. So vaccine is not an option. And similarly, there is no antiviral medication that can be given, unlike in influenza or in COVID-19. So over-the-counter medication is probably all that you would require. Drinking plenty of fluids, taking rest, taking cough suppressant if needed. And if you usually you don't run very high fevers in this condition, it's probably low-grade temperature, maybe taking acetaminophen is all that you can do.
How contagious is it? In other words, when you get something like this, like, for example, when I had my acute symptoms and I had to go to work, I wore a mask, and I usually wear a mask, but I insisted that patients wear a mask. Is that the best thing to do, or Should you isolate yourself at home? What should you be doing?
I mean, like almost with all viral respiratory infection, I mean, they are contagious. And, you know, we do shed these viruses in our mucus. And, you know, they are all spread mostly by droplet infection, droplet mode. So direct contact with the respiratory secretions and even secretion that are laid on, you know, surfaces. When somebody touches and then, you know, gets it on their nose or face, it can get it. So first question, you know, should you stay home? If you run a fever, if you have symptoms, you know, you should stay home. And until the fever and the other symptoms are significantly improved without any aid of other medication for 24 hours, you would be better off then to go to work. Now, if you go to work and, you know, for the next 5 days or so, wearing a mask would be appropriate and distancing from others is also appropriate. You know, as you know, the respiratory hygiene is one of the important things, you know, covering your cough, washing your hand frequently, if, you know, it's open water, and if that is not available, using a alcohol-based hand sanitizer frequently, especially after a sneeze or a cough, and, you know, making sure you wash your hands. Those are the things that is going to protect others from getting it from you. This also applies to cleaning surfaces frequently. You know, as you know, in our field, we make sure after each patient visit, we clean every surface in the room, obviously, whether they have cold or not. And these are the things that you would need to take as precautions.
Mike, what we're going to do is we're going to get ready to take a short break. And we want to talk a little bit more about this. Also, we want to get to some other topics. We're starting to see a lot of whooping cough or pertussis. There have been 8,064 cases already this year in the United States, as opposed to a little over 3,000 cases in the same similar period last year. We also want to talk to Dr. Raj Kumar about COVID, measles, and H5N1, the bird flu. If you have questions for me, you can reach out to me and Dr. Raj Kumar, and I'll ask him questions live on the air at info@alessimd.com. We're going to take a short break, and we'll get back to talk more with Dr. Raj Kumar about infectious diseases. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. I'm with my guest today, Dr. Michael Raj Kumar, and we're talking about infectious diseases. Mike, in at the break, we had a question come in from Francis, and the question was, for the common cold, do any things like vaporizers or neti pots help with congestion?
There is no specific recommendation whether that is going to help. I think, you know, general, I think the steam inhalation or vaporizer actually opens up a little bit of the respiratory tract, so it may not be harmful, and it can be of some benefit to some people. So if you are someone who is wanting to use it, it's not a contraindication, I would say.
What about vapor rub? Do you remember vapor rub? I mean, they still make
the Vicks?
Somebody stopped me the other day and said they use vapor rub. You know, the stuff you rub on your skin. Does that work?
They all have menthol in it.
Yeah.
And it kind of gives you a, you know, opens up your nasal passages and gives
it
you
does.
A little bit of a nice feeling, but it does not have any direct impact on the virus.
Okay. Great to know. Let's talk a little bit about pertussis. Before the break, I mentioned the numbers rising about whooping cough. I remember whooping cough because I had an uncle who I never knew, actually, who died as an infant from whooping cough in the 1920s. So what do we know about whooping cough?
So it is caused by a bacteria called Bordetella pertussis, and it is a highly contagious bacterial infection. And before vaccines were introduced, it caused havoc. As you said, your infant uncle passed. However, after the introduction of the vaccination, there has been significant decrease and mortality is not that high. However, we do see about 10,000 cases a year or so in our country. As it is a highly contagious disease, you know, it can easily spread. It often presents just like the common cold initially. However, it goes on to develop the prodromal symptom that where you start having these fits of cough with, at the end of the cough, the kind of gasp for air, which is what the whoop kind of thing, and that's why it's called whooping cough. And usually what happens is this, any symptoms start only about 5-10 days or sometimes even longer. And then the common cold symptoms last for about a week or two. And then you start to have the other symptoms with this whoop. And then some people will start vomiting after the end of this whoop and stuff like that. And then significant respiratory symptoms like breathing difficulty and all that can happen. So I think the best way that we can prevent this is using vaccination, as we have noted that since vaccination was introduced, there's a decrease in the number of cases as well as complications from these cases. But the vaccine is not 100% effective. Some of the studies have shown in children, especially in the infants and children, that the first year it is really good, you know, 98-100%. But subsequently, it drops off. Let's say in 5 years, it's probably about 70%. We as adults are asked to get vaccinated too. Then, you know, the Tdap vaccine that, you know, as an adult, we should get one vaccine. And that gives, again, a 70% the first year and maybe, you know, 40-50% as the years go on. So vaccination would be the best way to prevent pertussis.
Are you surprised the numbers are so high? I mean, already in the first 3 months of this year, we're at over 8,000, and you said we see about 10,000 per year.
I mean, I think we are.
Yeah.
You go ahead. Sorry.
No. Why do you think this is? Is it the vaccine? A lot of people denying the vaccine or refusing the vaccine?
See, also, I think I think the vaccine hesitancy is an issue. So obviously, the numbers are reflecting that. I don't think we can say anything as yet, because typically we see close to about 10,000 cases in the pre-pandemic area. So mm-hmm. Are we going to surpass that is kind of early to say at this point.
I have a question from Michael, and actually it fits right into my next topic. When you have the common cold and you think it's a common cold, should you be testing for COVID to make sure it's not COVID?
Okay, that goes without saying. In this day and age, when you get common cold symptoms, as we alluded to earlier, all of these viral infections do present initially similar. And there are some differences, of course, you know, with the COVID, you know, not now, but in the past, this smell and taste and the current variants seemingly is not doing that as much as it used to, the other variants. But in general, when you get these symptoms, I think it goes without saying that you should get tested for COVID. Once COVID is negative, then obviously you have other common, you know, viral infection should be the cause for it. You know, in the winter months, getting tested for influenza, of course, also goes without saying. But now moving forward, you know, COVID should be tested.
So where are we with COVID? I'm glad that came up because we wanted to get to that. Where are we with COVID in general? Is it getting less severe? Is it more rare now? What's your experience been?
So overall, the number of COVID cases have declined, you know, compared to 2 years ago or 3 years ago, we have significantly dropped. When we look at the CDC data tracker for COVID-19, week after week, what we are seeing is decreased percentage of test positivity. The CDC, through National Respiratory Enteroviral Surveillance Program, they take data from some of the Sentinel labs across the country and see what the percentage of labs, the COVID test that comes up positive. They have been decreasing steadily, and the last I saw, the percentage of testing has dropped down to 3.4%. Now, we must take one factor into consideration here, that since the end of the pandemic, you know, the emergency, public health emergency ending in May of 2023, yeah, we no longer have all tested, you know, data. And also people are getting testing done at home and they don't get reported. But these Sentinel labs are the same and we are monitoring in the same area and the numbers. And so there is a steady decline. And it is also reflecting on the ER visits. So as of this past week, the number of total number of ER visits across the country is 0.5% is for COVID. So this, even just in January, was 1.4. And if you were to go back to, say, last year, January, it was 2.5. And then in the peak in 2022, it was 13.8. So the number of ER visits for COVID-19 is steadily declining. Now, we can also contribute this to possibly people getting treated. You know, when they get tested at home, they're calling the primary care, they are getting Paxlovid. And so maybe that is reflecting on the number of ER visits. But overall, ER visits are decreased. Now, that's also now reflecting on the number of hospitalization and death. So right now, the hospitalization rate across the nation is 1.6 per 100,000. That was April 5. April 19 data is incomplete. Up to now, it is 0.9 per 100,000. When we were to look back, you know, in 2022-21, it was 521 per 100,000. So there is, you know, significant decline, and that's also reflecting on the number of deaths. You know, we have had more than 1.2 million deaths from COVID-19 since the pandemic started, but currently it is 0.7% of all deaths are attributed to COVID. So overall, I think we are on a better state than where we were. But even last year, there was a peak. I mean, we do have, you know, peaks and ebbs. And this is obviously related to which strain is circulating and how bad they are.
Do we have a way of predicting that? I mean, first of all, should we still be getting an annual vaccine for COVID? And do we have a way of predicting which strain is going to be the predominant one?
So there is a SARS-CoV surveillance program, which through CDC, they do genomic study on, you know, all the strain, you know, different ones. And they also use some of the commercial labs. So there is a constant monitoring of what is the variant that is circulating. Currently, there is a variant called LP8.1 that is the most common. The Omicron seems to have faded, and these variants are the ones that are currently circulating. For what we know, the vaccine that was given works for these, and as we move along, they will obviously give us recommendation as to what the vaccines that we need to take to, you know, prevent. I think annual vaccination probably should be the trend, given the fact that it's almost like becoming now just like the influenza, a seasonal infection. And, you know, there is always an increase during, you know, fall and winter months. So we might end up taking this, vaccination as an yearly annual vaccination.
Okay, so we should be still getting the annual vaccination usually in the fall, as would most of us have?
Yes.
Okay. Let's move on. Measles. Something that we thought was gone is now back due to vaccine hesitancy. Where are we with measles now, and what do you think the future is? Are we going to get control of this? Is it just going to keep spreading? What should we know about measles?
One good thing I can say for us living in Connecticut, we haven't had a case of measles in Connecticut. So that's the only good thing, I would say. But okay, as you know, there's well over 800 cases in 30 states. And you know the state where the most number of cases are going on. And
well, we have over 800 cases in Texas, so in West Texas, right there. So
yeah, and most of them are. Yeah, so you know the underlying reason we all know as a medical professional that it is lack of vaccination, because what we thought that we completely eradicated sort of, 15 years or whatever ago, is now slowly coming back. So that means that the immunity is not there, and that's why it is coming back. That is a question that's very hard to answer, because a lot depends on what kind of measures are going to be taken, and more than the measures going to be taken, how are the measures going to be accepted by sure. the people on the ground? And that is what will eventually determine which direction we are going to go.
What has protected us in Connecticut? Is it because we have a higher vaccination rate? Is that why we don't have a case here?
I suspect that is the only explanation that we can give at this point. However, as you know, that travel and other things to places, yep. People can, then bring it back. So we have been, somewhat lucky, I would say, that I do not have a good number on our state vaccination rate, but overall our state is high on vaccination. I did not check the DPH data, so I cannot give you an answer, sure. but it is truly probably the reason why we do not have yet a case in Connecticut.
Okay. All right. So as long as we keep up that vaccination rate, we should be okay here with respect to measles.
Yes, and that has been what our DPH folks have been recommending again and again, and I'm sure our pediatricians are on the forefront getting all the kids vaccinated.
Great. Let's move on to future threats. And I wanted to bring this up, and this is the bird flu, the H5N1 virus. Now, this has been around for a while, right? It's been killing birds for years, but suddenly there's been an uptick, and now we're seeing it in other species, including transferred to humans. So is this H5N1 virus, is this a threat for us as humans? And can you explain what it is? I mean, great numbers, but what does this H5N1 mean in terms of us in general and a threat to the population?
So as you alluded to, Tony, H5N1 virus is a virus that causes influenza in birds. So it's called avian or bird flu. Now, it's been there, mostly present in migratory wild birds, and we all knew about it. And since about 1997 or so, there has been sporadic cases of human cases, but never high in numbers. So in about 2021, 2022, there has been a transatlantic transfer through the birds, because there is a USDA and other folks, they monitor migratory birds, and they found this current strain, the H5N1, it's a clade that is 2.3.4.4b, that's what they call it. That clade made its way to the United States in late 2021-22. And then this is how it is, you know, from the wild birds, it gets to the, you know, poultry and backyard flocks, and then can get to the other domesticated and other animals. So basically, somewhere in 2023, there seems to be a spillover from the wild birds to poultry and cattle. And that's how we ended up finding in Texas, in the herds, the H5N1 strain in March 2024. Now, the spread to humans mostly occurred to people who are working in that environment where they were coming in contact with these herds or the poultry. So, there, you know, we know there's about total of 70 human cases in the United States, and they were mostly picked up after close monitoring of all these folks who were exposed to these infected animals. Well over 16,000 people were tested, and eventually only 64 of them turned positive. The other six were through, you know, usual national flu surveillance testing. So anyway, the total number of cases has been 70 and only one death. The most important thing in this is, so far, there has been no person-to-person spread. Three of these cases, they never had any exposure to any animals or poultry, so it was unclear how they got it. And one of the cases in California, that particular kid had antibodies, but none of his family or close contacts, none of them had antibodies. So it was clear that even though this person had H5N1, did not seem to have given it to anyone in his immediate family. So person-to-person spread is, at this point, not noted. So there is low risk for public health, but if there is mutations, now we all know viruses mutate, and in this particular virus, H5N1, there has been only low frequency of variants happening in the sequencing data. So may not have the same kind of risk SARS-CoV-2 had, but if mutations were to happen that would make it more effective to transmit, yes, there is certainly a possibility of this becoming more than what we have so far experiencing.
Yeah, and I guess that's the thing I worry about is the longer it exists, even in birds or in cattle now, the more chance for it to mutate, right, and strengthen itself, as we've learned from COVID. So should we be... as a society, should we be more aggressive in trying to get rid of this virus, even in birds and poultry and in cattle?
I mean, that is exactly what they are doing, you know, culling off, you know, thousands of or millions of these, yeah. You know, poultry and, you know, how that is going on. And the key here is, like, you know, I don't think we can completely get rid of every one of the animals, or for that matter, the wild birds. Sure. So they are doing what is humanly possible, I suppose, to control the spread of this. Unfortunately, what happened during the spread is these herds are, you know, moved across different states and other stuff, and the ones who had Some of them are asymptomatic and some of them are pre-symptomatic, and they did transfer to different herds. So you know, I think controlling the mixing of the herd population to, you know, avoid further spread among the, you know, cattle is one thing. And then, you know, when people encounter dead birds or dead animals, completely avoiding or using appropriate PPE to discard those, you know, animals. Those are the ways that we can currently control this. That's probably all we can do at this point.
Mike, in the last minute, usually I ask for something that we could all use to protect ourselves, but I guess I'm going to ask you a personal question. How do you stay healthy? I mean, you're around people with infectious diseases all day. And I know you personally, and how do you stay, what precautions do you take when you're around patients who you know have various infections?
So even though recommendations are mandated, the recommendations of masking is not there, you know, we only instituted during the winter months and whatnot, ever since the pandemic, you know. Myself and also my colleagues, you know, we all wear a mask at all times, other than when we are in our own personal surrounding. And, you know, and of course, the hand washing, this is the biggest, you know, pet peeve of many of the infectious disease doctors, is initiating, you know, and continued hand washing technique, and we do monitor those things. So washing, you know, every time, whether you enter a room and when you exit the room, making sure you wash your hands. I also personally always clean my stethoscope after each patient encounter, whether it is in my office or in the hospital. And I think all of those put together probably is keeping you safe.
Thank you, Mike. Mike, thank you for everything you do, and thank you for the time you spent with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me in the program, Tony. Thank you. Bye-bye.
We're going to have to wrap things up as we're getting ready for baseball. We'll be back live on Healthy Rounds next week. Until then, please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford HealthCare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.